Good afternoon. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum luncheon today. As many of you know, the Independent Institute regularly sponsors programs featuring outstanding experts to address major social and economic issues, especially as they relate to important new books, and today is certainly no exception. For those of you new to the Institute, you'll find a packet at your seat with background information on our work. For those of you also new to us, the Independent Institute is a nonprofit, non-politicized, scholarly research organization located here in the Bay Area. We produce about 8 or 10 books a year. We hold luncheons like this every 2 months or so, but we also get involved in quite a number of other projects involving people in the media and so on. The range of the topics that we address not only include law, but also economics and history and many other areas as they relate to critical public issues. Our purpose at the Institute is a Jeffersonian one of seeking truth regarding the impact of government policies and not necessarily just to tell people what they might want to hear. In so doing, we will not take the public pronouncements of government officials at face value or the conventional wisdom over serious public problems. As a result, we often end up getting into issues that tend to be quite provocative and hopefully informative. The Institute neither seeks nor accepts government funding, instead drawing our support from a broad diversity of private sources, and we invite you to become a member of our program. Members receive new copies of books, our new journal, The Independent Review, which premieres this month, and much more. Our program today is a very special one, and in making this Independent Policy Forum possible, I want to especially thank the members of our host committee. I also want to thank John Scalia and Eric George from the Feller Society for their kind assistance, and those who are here who are members of the Federalist Society. Frustration with America's increasingly Byzantine legal system has led to numerous calls for piecemeal reform, yet few experts have articulated a vision for reforming the legal system as a whole. While the White House and Congress tinker with the rate of growth of government spending and whether the welfare state is better administrated at the federal or the state level, the eminent legal scholar and author Richard Epstein has been challenging the very roots of the liability crisis and the legal nature and effects of the regulatory welfare state. In his widely acclaimed new book, Simple Rules for a Complex World, Epstein presents a new legal framework to restore a Jeffersonian society based on individual rights, freedom to choose, and the rule of law. In his book, he echoes the thoughts of the founding fathers and such scholars as the late Nobel laureate economist F.A. Hayek. He vividly demonstrates why, as a society becomes ever more complex, the rules that govern behavior should be made simpler, not more complicated. This is not to say that simplicity alone is sufficient for a just, productive, and humane society, but that, quote, complex rules breed uncertainty, which breeds litigation, which in turn diverts scarce resources from productive uses, unquote. At this Independent Policy Forum, Professor Epstein will employ these principles to evaluate many of the thousands of burdensome and counterproductive regulations, taxes, and other government policies. Since publication of his highly acclaimed 1985 book, Takings, Professor Epstein has become widely regarded as perhaps the preeminent legal contrarian, quote unquote, of our time, challenging the philosophies of many liberals and conservatives alike. His path-breaking scholarship and penetrating analyses have launched a quiet revolution to restore the central importance of property rights to the law and to society in general, earning him the respect of even his staunchest critics. Indeed, the entire movement to recognize and employ the Takings Clause is due to his seminal work. Now, with the escalating anti-political sentiment of the public and the growing demand to de-bureaucratize and depoliticize American life, Epstein's powerful and learned call for devolution, tort reform, economic liberalization, and privatization could not be more timely. He is the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago, a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, as well as the California Bar. He's editor of the prestigious journal, The Journal of Law and Economics, and has also been a research fellow of the Independent Institute. In fact, his new study, which was just finished, which is on healthcare policy called Anti-Discrimination in Healthcare, is available here for those who are interested in that issue. He's further renowned for his expertise in communications, criminal law, legal history, private property, jurisprudence, real estate development and finance, land use, taxation, torts, and workers' compensation. He's a graduate of Oxford and Columbia Universities. He tells great lawyer jokes, by the way. He also received his LLB cum laude from Yale Law School and is the author of many influential books, including Bargaining with the State, Forbidden Grounds, Labor Law and Employment Market, and others. He's also the author of over 160 articles and reviews in various scholarly journals, ranging from the Harvard Law Review, American Journal of Legal History, Stanford Law Review, Texas Law Review, California Law Review, and many others. And he's also published widely in such newspapers and magazines as the Wall Street Journal, Chicago Tribune, New Republic, Washington Post, Legal Times, and so forth. It gives me great pleasure, and I know that you will enjoy in welcoming Richard Epstein.
You can take these things. Actually, what I thought I would do is I would devote 3 seconds to each of the topics in which I'm supposed to have some degree of expertise, and that way I could prove the most important thing about it, which is my ability to speak nonstop and make no sense as I go along. Somehow or other, I don't think that's going to be appropriate, but I think I will begin with some kind of a general lament. I mean, Dave, when I was described me as America's leading legal contrarian, there is both an honor and a liability associated with that particular position. It means that you're able to start out and to tread where others fear to go. But on the other hand, to the extent that you remain a contrarian for the 20-odd years that you push a particular line, you start to wonder when it is that you're going to require this exalted status of majoritarian and have somebody treat you in the uncomfortable position of being the conventional wisdom on some subject. Just once in my life, I would like to be thought to be not only clever, urbane, witty, but just simply have the much humbler designation of correct. It doesn't seem to come very easily to somebody in my position, I'm sorry to say. And in fact, what I have to do is to constantly remind myself of the academic credo, which it's essentially what you do is you follow the argument to where it leads, and if the crowd decides to follow with you, so much the better. And if it doesn't, you take comfort in the fact that the kinds of positions that you're pushing are necessary in order to lend some degree of balance to the public debate. And indeed, when we start to worry about this time in life and in politics generally, and this is, again, by way of sort of oratorical introduction, one of the things that really troubles me so much is I think that while there is an enormous amount of discontent with respect to the way our public institutions are running, there is an enormous volatility about the way in which they could possibly go. That is, I do not see here the signs of discontent with the status quo pointing very strongly in a direction of the liberalization of the sort that David described. I see in the hands of some people a very powerful form of populist impulses, which sometimes spring forth the darkest spirits of our natures and, in fact, create a rather illiberal sentiment. And I don't mean by that the 20th century variety of liberalism. I mean the 19th century variety of liberalism. And to give you an idea of just how crazy the situation can often be, when people start to describe the world in either left or right terms and kind of treat everything as though it could be arrayed along a single dimension, folks say, oh, we understand that you're an extreme right winger, so that means I'm out there with the Freeman and Upper State Montana. Somehow or other, I'm out there with the Ku Klux Klan. And indeed, when I wrote my book on Forbidden Grounds, which was the case for the abolition of the employment discrimination laws insofar as they applied to private competitive markets, no further than that, I've been branded as a defender of Jim Crow on the grounds that everybody knows that Jim Crow and free markets mean the same thing and that it's only a form of government benevolence which could protect us from these sorts of illnesses. And if, in fact, you have that degree of confusion, that kind of kind of uncertainty about where you're going to go, where populism in one moment can be in favor of deregulation of the public utilities and in the next moment in favor of their nationalization. It seems to me that you are faced with a political situation which should leave everybody with a profound sense of disease. What makes it even worse is that I think with the time that we have now, and the role of intellectuals in dealing with this current situation have only shifted from bad to worse. There is a new term about in the last year or two or three, and I'm sure it's been around before then, the so-called public intellectual, which is the individual who takes those things that you learn, generally speaking, in the academy and then tries to transport them into the world of public affairs. And I guess to some extent the moment that somebody stands up here and gives some kind of a speech, perforce you become some form of a public intellectual. But it's a very risky business to get involved in, and it's one that leaves me profoundly uneasy, because the question is whether or not you're going to take a series of results that to some extent are unpalatable or difficult to understand or which go against the political grain and kind of just migrate a little bit the way in which an expert witness may do under oath in order to make a position which is going to have some degree of political splash or appeal of something else. And it's a constant tension, as far as I'm concerned, in my own business, to make sure that when you translate the ideas that you have as an academic to the public at large, you do so in exactly the way in which you think about them. You may not present all the detailed research, but you want to try and keep some degree of the appropriate balance. So I think we're living in very troublesome times. I think the sense that we have too many nostrums out there and not enough cures is one that is wide. And so rather than starting from the political side of this thing, as I slowly wind myself back to the topic of the speech, what I'm going to do is to try and approach the questions of politics by indirection. That is, by training and by origin, and even to some extent by temperament, I'm a common lawyer. And what that means, in effect, is not that I'm just an ordinary bloke who doesn't care much about anything. It's rather somebody who kind of thinks that the way in which you understand, the way in which legal principles evolve, is you start to work up from particular cases, which seem to be far removed from the controversy at hand, and then by a process of analogy and extension, explain how it is that your understanding of these particular problems shape and organize the kind of discourse that you're involved with. And here what I propose to do, in effect, is to kind of give an overview of the way in which I understand the legal system, and then try to indicate the way in which this would apply to one problem, which I don't discuss at great length, perhaps not even at all, in Simple Rules for a Complex World, but which came to the fore at least during the Buchanan campaign, and which I think we could be confident will come back to the fore in future times. That is the question of free trade and protectionism, which is the kind of issue which is, of course, I think, of absolutely vital importance to the entire nation, and of special importance to a place like California, positioned as it is on a coast with ready access not only to Mexico and Canada, but of course to the Pacific Rim. So let us then begin with the abstract and obscure theory, go through a few cases having to do with African tribes and their trading relationships with the English ships, and then try to get to free trade. It's a rather tortuous journal, but I think, in fact, that the more indirect you make the trick, in some sense, the more persuasive the intellectual case. Well, when you're trying to organize a legal system at the general, what you do is you have the following kind of omnipresent constraint that is present in all these circumstances. And that constraint, quite simply, is that there are lots of people to go around and there are lots of goods, but if you wanted to divide the world in a way in which each individual thought to be just, you would find that you would have to allocate 150, 250, 500% of the available goods. Each person in this world has a clear recognition that scarcity is abiding constraint, and I think people do understand that, but somehow or other, when they start to think about the modes of allocation, it turns out that the set of wants is always greater than the sets of needs that are going to be able to satisfy them. And the question about a legal rule is to figure out how it is you decide which of those sets of desires are going to have to be disappointed in order to make sure that you will be able to get the set of allocations down so that individuals and goods will somehow or other come into equilibrium. You cannot assign the same good to two or more individuals unless you wish to risk some sort of hopeless conflict between them. But by the same token, you don't want to leave things that are of value utterly without owners so that there is some degree of waste that's associated with the operation of the system. And so that the first task, therefore, you have is running this kind of matching sort of arrangement. When you do that, what are the kinds of resources that you can start to deal with? Well, one of the resources that you could start to deal with is good old human beings and human labor, which is, of course, an immense importance in any system from the most primitive to the most modern. And most of us don't even think about the question of how it is that we allocate the rights to human labor and human entitlements and so forth, because we're so committed to what lawyers and philosophers have called the autonomy principle that we scarcely reflect to figure out why it is that this is such a powerful principle of social organization. But essentially, the first principle of any just society, it seems to me, is one which talks about individual self-ownership, the ability of each person to determine exactly what will be done with his or her body, how it is those labors and talents will start to be deployed. There are going to be various kinds of questions about the limits and the way in which these talents could be used, but at least the first question is not what are the limits of the use. The first question turned out to be, who are those individuals who are entitled to be the users, and who are those individuals who are going to be the bystanders? And here, in effect, the matching principle that one talks about gets rid of the scarcity problem in a very neat way. It says that for each body there is one owner, and that's the person who happens to reside in it in advance. There is no way in which you have to go through elaborate principles of acquisition and negotiation in order to decide whether or not you own your own body. It just simply turns out to be the starting point from which all of the deliberations take place. Now, the question is, why is it that you believe in such an odd principle, if in fact you do believe in it? And most of you would say, I really haven't given it much thought, which is another way of saying that it's so obvious that why do I have to listen to anybody explain to me about its various virtues? But it's an instructive inquiry, because the question that you really want to ask in a more systematic form is, if in fact you're going to reject the principle, what is it that you're going to put in its place? And here it turns out there are a set of alternatives, none of them which I think turn out to be terribly palatable, but at least one of which turns out to be enormously fashionable. Well, one of the other rules that we could have, in effect, is to say, look, instead of having a theory of individual self-ownership, we're going to tolerate some degrees of slave economies, in which some people will not only own themselves, but will own other individuals, and other people will just sort of be out of luck and will not own themselves, and of course will not own anybody else. We could, I assume, imagine more complicated patterns of allocation, in which it turns out that somebody is the slave of A, and it turns out to be the owner of B, and let it figure out exactly what it means to control an individual when you have somebody else, when you have no rights to control yourself, but we'll pass by at least those kinds of complicated transactions for the moment. And the issues that come up with slavery are very profound, but the simplest way in which to put it is just who's going to be in this preferred position and why. Once you reject conquest as a source of entitlement with respect to other individuals, you have to kind of think of life as being a complicated lottery in which if every person is either a slave or a slave owner, you get a 50% chance of assuming either position by some sort of glorious roll of the dice. Now, if you were to do that and just ask yourself whether you would enter into that lottery as opposed to a system of self-ownership, I think I know that the answer to that question is going to be perfectly clear. That generally you'll take 100% of a sure thing than 50% of a rather risky thing, because as we like to say in the gambling business, the downside of this bet is really very, very bad indeed. Now, why is this important if it's obvious? Because I think it starts to tell you the following thing about the way in which people think about legal rules, which is they basically have the intuition that they're all deontological in their origins. That is, there's some kind of immanent principle of justice, which if you don't bother to reflect about it, somehow or other you're going to be able to apply it just correctly. And that most people, when they're intuitive, they tend to be kind of natural lawyers in, as we heard, the Jeffersonian tradition. And that's the right place to end up politically, but analytically it strikes me as being the wrong place. That is, essentially virtually every time we appeal to antecedents, we do so by a justification that starts to look to consequences. That to some extent the way in which you have to think about the shape and the organization of all legal institutions is the way in which when the rules are generally applied, it will work for the set of individuals who are subject to their governance. And that we ought not to shrink from the idea that somehow or other this form of utilitarian calculus, this form of economic logic, if you will, is going to be part and parcel of discourse, because it seems to me on the simplest questions, it's exactly that kind of logic which explains and fortifies our strongest moral intuitions. Now, if you start to use this, there's another way of thinking about the question of individual ownership, which is much more fashionable and dates from what in the philosophical language is called the Rawlsian tradition, which says that no individual has the right of ownership over his or her natural talents. It's all a matter of a natural lottery one way or another as to who got what set of skills. And so what happens is everybody has a part claim on the intelligence of other individuals. And so instead of having a regime of individual self-ownership in the good old Lockean tradition, you have a regime of sharing shared ownership in this more modern tradition. And what this starts to leave you with is, at the very least, a system of very strong redistributivist taxes. So that the autonomy principle isn't so self-evident to a large number of individuals after all. And I think in answer to that, the question you would then have to say is exactly how it is that you're going to work this elaborate system of joint and mutual ownership. And one of the things that you typically discover is, if I don't own myself, what is it that gives me the right to vote with respect to what I want when I may not be the person who's entitled to decide what happens to me? Or what gives me the right to enter into contracts to sell and to dispose of my labor, or to buy particular goods, or to occupy a vacant piece of land, or indeed everything? Is it going to be the situation in which a committee of the whole is going to describe what is going to be the action of each of the individuals? And here we're going to have a set of revolving and interlocking directorates, which are so sufficiently complicated that all of us will wish for the simpler world of individual self-determination. So that, again, it seems to me that the way in which one starts to deal with the question of joint and common ownership is, in effect, to kind of project out the consequences that would it give in the event of its full implementation, to discover that, in the end, if we require the consent of all before anybody can do anything, we should all starve before anyone would be able to eat, that it is better to have a little bit of individual egotism in the system rather than to try and rest on the assumption that, to the extent that we have unanimous consent, we're always going to be working with a set of rules which is better than those which allow a little bit of unilateral action. And it's from just that understanding, I think, that the proper empirical basis starts to take place with respect to claims for individual liberty. It turns out also that it's the root of the understanding with respect to property. One of the most reviled rules of property acquisition at the common law was, in fact, a rule which says that the way in which you take possession of things in a state of nature is to grab them. That is, the initial position says that everything out there in the world at large is generally unowned, and the first occupant could then exclude the rest of the world. And while this will have certain major difficulties with respect to water and with air, for which, in fact, the rules of common law very cleverly adjusted, with respect to land and chattels, notwithstanding all of the fantastic transformations that have taken place in the way in which husbandry and development has proceeded over the generations, it is still the most efficient rule whatsoever that you could imagine. And the explanation for it, I think, is perfectly clear. If you don't have that rule, you're going to have some other rule. And to the extent that you have a rule which requires for you to deal with the questions of multiple consent, it means that before anybody can eat, we're going to have an elaborate system of governance in place, and we're going to have to decide who is going to be part of the polity, who will be excluded, what is going to be the principles of representation, and how things are going to proceed. It's too complicated to make the system go. A rule which, in effect, allows things to be owned and to be taken from a state of nature and put under private ownership creates all sorts of incentives with respect to their development. And when you take into account the third of the simple rules that I talk about in their book, what it also does is it gives you the way in which others who are non-takers in the original auction can become winners in the second round. And that's through the prospect of voluntary exchange. That is, what happens is you have very egotistical rules, or so apparently egotistical rules, with respect to the ownership of labor and the ownership of external things. Now, it turns out that in a world without trade, the only value that you can get from these things is through their actual use. But to the extent that there is an efficiency through the division of labor and through voluntary exchange, you must have a system of voluntary contract which will allow these things to be moved from their original taker to somebody else. Now, it may well be a terrible thing for somebody to sell himself into slavery, but each of us does it on the installment plan every time we take a job and decide that we're going to subject ourselves to the instruction of the wisdom of an employer or of an independent contractor of somebody else. With a logic of exchange, unlike the logic of slavery, however, is that in each case, and it's a proposition I think that has been long and well understood but too easily forgotten, the reason why we like exchange is not because we have some abstract moral predilection in favor of keeping as opposed to breaking promises, but because we know enough about scarcity and individual self-interest that we're quite confident that the only time that you will enter into an exchange is where you expect to get more from it at the back end than you have to surrender today. That is, what happens is the fundamental agency of social exchange is mutual gain from trades. And it turns out that one of the reasons why you have to be so insistent upon the rules with respect to the individual ownership of self and the individual ownership of things that are external to the self is that unless you have those two rules in place, it turns out that subsequent voluntary exchange will be impossible to realize. And if you cannot realize these exchanges, it means that you freeze yourself into whatever inefficient allocation of resources is decreed by some kind of an alternative rule. So that again, the way in which we start to correct the mistakes and injustices that exist by systems of arbitrary allocation are through voluntary exchanges. As between the two parties, these things tend to have positive payoffs, and they also have positive payoffs with respect to what is sometimes called externalities. This is a very long and very popular word amongst the economists and the lawyers in the trade, and it's one which kind of has a tinned sound with respect to individuals who think about legal issues but have not been schooled in either of these two disciplines. Essentially, an externality is something which says anytime A engages in a certain activity, it's going to have consequences which will affect other people who do not participate in the action which he's undertaken. But when you think about externalities, the usual way to think about them is being strictly negative. I will engage in acts that pollute the environment. I will take the profit. Other people will bear the loss. And so therefore, externalities are regarded as negatives. And since they're negatives, they have to be things that are restrained rather than things that are encouraged. But fortunately, the world doesn't always work that way. When you're dealing with exchange, for the most part, the externalities are positive. That is, other people will be better off by virtue of the fact that A and B are entitled to enter into a voluntary exchange with each other. And you ask yourself, now, why or how could that be the case? And well, it's relatively simple if you think about it. Since the two of us have gained by a voluntary exchange, each of us has more wealth and more satisfaction than we had before, at least on average. And when you have lots of transactions, it's the averages that matter, not the outliers. And to the extent that we have more, we could take the stuff that we acquired in one set of exchanges and re-exchange it for yet something else that we want. And the process can keep on going so long as the legal system facilitates and doesn't frustrate exchanges. And whenever judges start to explain why it is that this, that, or the other contract ought not to be enforced, they have to always ask the question as to whether or not they're part of the solution or whether they're part of the problem. Whether or not this is a situation in which the negative nature of the externalities are strong enough to override the voluntary arrangement, or whether they've just fundamentally misunderstood the transaction and are interfering with the kinds of situations that should be allowed to go forward, which is the typical norm with respect to the usual voluntary sale of goods, the lending of goods and money, and something of the sort. Now, if you have these three facilitative rules, one of the questions you have to figure out, what's the downside of them? That is, nobody who's going to start to talk in a serious fashion about the creation of legal rules under condition of scarcity can announce to you that every time you create a rule, it's pure benefit and no cost. There's always a cost when you exclude people from property, or when in effect you allow one person to enter into a voluntary trade. Somebody else might have wished to enter into a trade with the person who has traded with a third, and so on down the line. But what happens is you have enough confidence that in the long run, the net benefits are going to be large enough and will be widely distributed that you're willing to impose these correlative duties. And it's the law of tort, generally speaking, the law of wrongs, which explains exactly what those correlative duties are. And the first of them, in effect, is if we really believe in the sanctity of the person, we have powerful protections against insult and battery that one person may impose upon another. And if we really believe in the importance of property, maybe not the sanctity of property, we have powerful constraints against taking goods, destroying goods, converting property of one sort or another. These are not the sort of issues that are going to appear in the courts of the judges very often. And it's not because they aren't very important. It's because they're so important that the legal principles ought not to be subject to serious doubt, except in the most extreme cases. And one of the things that I would urge you when you're thinking about the law is never worry too much about what the appellate cases do. First, understand the way the system operates on the simplest of cases, and then if you understand why those cases are rightly or wrongly decided, you can deal with the luxury of handling the most hard and difficult cases. And basically, even to this very day, notwithstanding all the things that government does, and government does badly, it's the protection of the individual liberty and the protection of property are still first and second on the list. Third on the list turns out to be, in many cases, I think, the protection of the exchange relationship. That is, this whole contract stuff. And protection comes in two forms. One is the enforcement of the agreement is between the parties, for otherwise I will never enter into a contract where I have to perform first if I know when the time for return performance comes that other fellow will be nowhere to be found. I'm in the business of making exchanges. I'm not in the business of making gifts. But the protection of the exchange relationship also involves protection against third parties. So that if somebody tries to disrupt a prospective contract between me and somebody else, that's got to be treated as a tort on a par with killing somebody or injuring somebody. Now, what's the case that we talk about it? Remember I mentioned to you that there was the question about the African trade. Well, it turns out that it is possible to enter into exchanges with individuals or groups from totally alien cultures, even under circumstances where there's no mechanism of contractual enforcement between the parties. That is, one can easily postulate a set of circumstances in which the gains from maintaining a relationship are so large for both sides that if you just simply were to go to the beach and drop down a bunch of goods, they will pick those goods up and leave a set of skins or trinkets in exchange because they want to make sure that you come back tomorrow. And the particular goods on the beach, if stolen, are worth less to them than the continuation of the relationship. And therefore, you can have what is known in the trade as a system of self-enforcing contracts. But no system of self-enforcing contracts will work if at the time that you're about to head to the beach, somebody takes out a well-positioned howitzer and starts firing bullets so as to make sure that you or your trading partners will flee. And the common law dating back to the 14th century in the case of the schoolmen and the 18th century in the case of the African trade, in both cases said that the disappointed trader, even if he was not injured or scratched by any of the bullets that were fired, could nonetheless maintain an action for the loss of expectation, even though he kept the property. That is, the property may be worth $1,000 to him if he kept it, and worth $2,000 if he sold it and exchanged it. You could get that $1,000 of profit even if you kept your goods. So important was the exchange relationship. Now, from here to international free trade is a very short step. You see, this is the genius of the common lawyer, I like to think, is your ability to make preposterous analogies sound perfectly sensible. That is, what do I mean by that? Well, suppose it turns out that instead of worrying about the African trade, we assume that I'm an American manufacturer who wants to enter into a contract with a Japanese firm in which we're willing to create legal relationships. I will ship certain goods to that firm, and that firm will ship either cash or goods back to me. The question is, do we protect this contract under the simple rules against interference by third parties? Say, a rival firm that might want to disrupt that arrangement so that all the trade will be kept domestic, either in Japan or in the United States. Now, it is characteristic of the American government with respect to its anti-dumping rules, with respect to its tariff rules, with respect to its quantitative restriction rules, and so forth. I don't care about the choice of technique. I just care about the fact of intervention. Then in each and every one of these cases, we side with the guy who's shooting the howitzers over the bow of the other boat. We don't side with the guy who wants to enter into the voluntary exchange. That is, the only reason we don't have violence today is that the threat of public force, which can disrupt the exchange relationship, is so powerful that nobody chooses to resist. And the way in which you could understand the case for free trade is simply to analogize the government when it disrupts a voluntary exchange between a citizen on the one hand and a foreigner on the other hand, as being no different from that other fellow in that little longboat who decided to disrupt the trade between the English ship on the one hand and the African tribes, the natives, on the other. The question is why and how we would want to justify that relationship then becomes the key question. Well, one thing you want to immediately dismiss is the idea that somehow or other we do this because we're protecting individuals from various kinds of harm. This is not a situation where the first guy was trying to muscle out the second guy. In fact, one of the things about every trade relationship is that it is deservedly fragile in the sense that to the extent that you can no longer supply goods at a lower price or a higher quality than your competitor, you will lose out to them. The legal system protects the exchange relationship. It doesn't guarantee you a trading partner. It doesn't put anybody in the position where they're compelled to deal with you against your will or their will, so that you can be perfectly secure in the way in which you conduct your affairs while they conduct theirs in utter kinds of slavery, if you will, from somebody else. The equality of persons, which we talk about with respect to autonomy in the original position, has to carry over with respect to voluntary exchange. Unless two want the tango, there ought to be no dance. And to the extent that I can offer you a position on my dance card and you reject it, I ought to be required to, shall we, bear the insult, the hurt, and the shame as best as I possibly can. Now, the question then comes in, can you think of any other sort of justification which would want to allow these sorts of interferences to take place? And I really can think of none. It is often said that what this will do will be protect American businesses against the competition which comes from abroad. And the protection language and the security language that is used is often extremely attractive, because what it's designed to do is to evoke the kinds of images we had with respect to the basic common law rules that protect the integrity of the person, protect private property, and protect the exchange relationship. But there is, in fact, a fundamental difference in the way in which these two kinds of systems operate. In one case, what happens is the protection that is given will raise the level of utility, of happiness, of satisfaction of all participants to the system. But the moment you start dealing with protective tariffs, there is nothing that you can do to universalize the rules in question. It's the guys who make widgets who are going to be protected. The fellows who make gadgets are the fellows who are going to have to pay the price. This is not a system in which you have a rising tide which raises all boats. This is a system in which you're engaged in preferences. How does it then work? Well, here it turns out that there's a real and genuine paradox. The major function of legal rules, as far as I can see, is to protect the security of person, the security of property, and the security of exchange. What typically happens under these circumstances is the moment you have selective protection, you have done that for one individual, but what have you done for the others? The answer is you've increased the risk with which they have to do business, because it's as though you had a firm which had a bunch of common stock. And then what you say to one individual is, I want you to know we're giving out some debt paper to somebody else's against those assets. You'll still have your common stock. Why do you get upset about the fact that we've given somebody a preferred position? The answer is that your position is much riskier, because it turns out that not only do you have to bear all the ordinary vicissitudes of the business, but you stand second in line for the way in which you take the profits. And so what typically happens is the moment you start to engage in various forms of protectionism, what you do is you impose a very heavy set of risks on the firms that are going to bear these particular burdens. At the same time, you're trying to give some palliative to those firms who get the protection. And you have no idea that the right size is going to take place between benefits and burdens, because there's never a voluntary exchange between the party that gets the benefit of protection and the party which has to bear its losses. This is therefore very different from a standard insurance contract, where I'm willing to assume risk from you precisely because you pay me a premium. Here, in effect, you switch the risk, but the premium is never going to be paid. It also turns out that when you try to engage in activities like this, it's a hopeless endeavor in any effect. And this, again, is not new news to anybody who's followed the literature on international trade, because it goes back to David Ricardo. But let me just tell you what the phenomenon is and why it is that it's so utterly self-destructive to think that protectionism will give you some degree of comfort as a nation. Let us suppose that what you decide to do is to protect your goods, and you think the only thing that you're going to regulate is the exchange relationship in the commodities that come into your country. Well, it turns out that legal and economic systems are not closed, no matter what it is that the lawyers think is at stake. Everything, to some extent, is connected to everything else. The moment you start putting restrictions on what can be imported or exported into a country, it turns out that you will have predictable and adverse effects on the rate of exchange with respect to the currencies. And this means, for example, that if you could now import fewer goods from Japan because we've got some kind of protective quota in there, it turns out that the demand for the Japanese currency is going to decline because you're going to be buying fewer Japanese goods. So instead of having to have an exchange rate at 100 yen per dollar, it may be 110. The moment the exchange rates change, of course, what that means is that your ability to export is going to be hurt, because you're going to be going into a teeth of an adverse market when you try to sell. That is, the change in the exchange rates will result in a price disadvantage in the export markets, which will offset whatever gains you hope to get by way of protection. So when you put the whole piece together, you lose both ways. You lose coming on imports and going with respect to exports. And it's the kind of policy which creates social futility and at the same time does so at enormous cost. If there's any lawyer in this room who has worked in an anti-dumping proceedings, you will understand why they're called full employment acts for lawyers. In the effort to try to reconstruct the cost structure in another country in order to make out claims of unfair competition, it turns out you lose them all. And let me therefore end on this note, which takes off on the unfair competition point for just one second. That is, generally speaking, fairness is an extremely powerful tool for understanding the basic relationships we've talked about before on the labor and autonomy and so forth. But like every good term, it could be pressed into bad service. And the moment you start hearing somebody talking about unfair competition, you have to immediately prick up your ears and ask, what form of unfairness is at stake? If you're dealing with the kind of unfairness which deals with deception or with coercion, you ought to be very sympathetic to the claim. But if it turns out that unfairness simply means that we've won a race and you happen to lose, then at that time the claim should be greeted with profound suspicion. And so much of what talks about unfair competition in the initial international arena is simply the fact that domestic competition cannot meet up with low-cost foreign supplies. And that's not a good argument within the domestic context, and it ought not in a legal sense be a good argument in the foreign context. And so what happens is, once you understand the way in which the rules of property tie in with the rules of the person, tie in with the rules of exchange, it doesn't only tell you about simple two-party transactions or little common law disputes. It gives you an enormous window to understanding very much more large and complicated social arrangements. And when you understand them, the things that David talked about start to resonate with greater power. Even if you don't understand the full details of the system, once you start stressing individual liberty, strong property, and voluntary exchange, you're not going to go too far wrong most of the time. There are some qualifications. They're going to have to wait for another day. For the most part, however, remember that if you understand 90% of the truth, you're going to do a lot better in figuring out the way the qualifications work than if you figure out the 10% of the exceptions and assume that the world is just filled and replete with very difficult and controversial cases. So I'm not going to say that we've given you perfection here, but I hope at least we've given a long step down the road. Thanks so much for your patience. Want to take some questions?